6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by.
And welcome to this Wednesday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, your guest host for today, John Quinlan. Of course, many of you know I'm usually here on Mondays, and because of holiday beginning of year considerations, filling in today on Wednesday. I have a very exciting show ahead of us. I'm speaking with Professor Sarah Richardson from Harvard University about her new book, Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. And this is a book that traces the history of genetic theories of sex differences from about 1900 to the present, and demonstrates how the human X and Y chromosomes became pillars of a particular way of thinking about biological sex. And what Professor Richardson attempts to do is to show us how over the course of the 20th century that X and Y became kind of objects of scientific knowledge. In concluding chapters, what she tries to say is there's a different way of conceptualizing genetic sex differences as we enter this, what we call the post-genomic age. So essentially, very interesting, nuanced questions about the difference between the definitions of gender and sex. Trying to, break away from some of the stereotypical notions of, what determines sex and get kind of to the basic empirical, basis for how this may be connected to genetics itself. It should just be a fascinating discussion, a way of kind of stripping away some of the myths and misconceptions and getting at the essence of what these things mean. So Sarah Richardson is our guest. She is a professor at Harvard University, and she has had a long history of working on these issues. She's a historian and philosopher of science, and her research focuses on race and gender in the biosciences and on the social dimensions of scientific knowledge. She has broad interest and expertise in the history of molecular biology, biomedicine, genetics, philosophy of science, science and technology studies, and feminist science studies. So, once again, looking forward to a fascinating discussion with Sarah Richardson. Hey, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thanks for having me, Don.
It's so good to have you here. And why don't we start in a really basic place? I think, some of the distinctions that you're making, throughout your book are tied up in, I think, mistaken notions of what we're talking about when we're talking about sex or we're talking about gender. Are those important distinctions to understand?
Absolutely. Sometime in the 1960s and 1970s, feminist scholars, but also people working in the clinical context, working with people who are called intersex, people with different gender expressions, realized that we needed to make a distinction between the biological conception of sex and the social and cultural expectations around sex performance, which they called gender. So this distinction between sex and gender is a distinction that is valuable for thinking about sex as a multi-layered concept that is both biological and then involves various cultural expressions, which can vary over history and across time and, of course, from individual to individual, regardless of what their biological sex is.
Well, let's, again, taking this back in terms of the historical context for it, X and Y chromosomes were discovered a little over 100 years ago, and more recent development is the completion of the what we call the Human Genome Project. Could you relate those two developments and how they inform this discussion?
Sure. I mean, it's actually astonishing to think that we didn't know about the X and Y chromosomes as the basis of sex determination until just 100 years ago. So I actually begin the story in the late 19th century, that era of buttoned-up floor-length black dresses and conservative gender values. And I ask, what was our conception of sex before the sex chromosomes? And it turns out that the biological understanding of sex before the X and Y, that vivid binary at the level of the genome, actually was that sex was highly plastic. It was very labile. sex was not determined right at conception, but in fact could be influenced by environmental factors, by which ovary the egg implanted in, and other factors within the mother and within the egg. And so the X and Y actually represented a dramatic shift in our understanding of sex, the notion that there is some determinant down at the level of the germplasm of the gene that ultimately determines maleness or femaleness, really shifted things to a much more binary understanding of sex. And as I argue in the book, the X and Y have become little symbols of the kind of hard end of the sex gender spectrum that we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, here in the genomic age, we have a much more flexible understanding of gender, of hormones, of surgical reconstruction and sexual morphology, but the sex chromosomes remain kind of the last vestige of this kind of hard, binary, essentialist idea of maleness and femaleness instantiated in biology at the level of the genome. And so this is kind of a final frontier as we look into the genomic age and see the sex chromosomes finally being sequenced and learn quite a bit more about their biology and their ambiguous and ambivalent relationship to sex and gender.
Are we essentially kind of revisiting the notion of nature versus nurture? And I guess within that debate, whether there's sort of a binary construction that is one or the other, or whether these things exist along a spectrum?
Right, right. You know, the history of the sex gender debate has really been this bouncing back and forth between ideas of the naturalness and inevitability and fixedness of sex and looser ideas of sex as highly variable. And this is reflected in the science itself. As a historian and philosopher of science, of course, what interests me is both the content of the science, but also its interactions with social and cultural context, which I think the sex chromosomes provide an exquisite example of this. They're kind of these objects that traffic, if you will, between culture as these very enriched objects of cultural meaning, but also scientific knowledge.
Yeah, no, I have a real appreciation for this conversation. I was a returning student a few years ago, and two classes that really stood out in that experience were an LGBT studies class, where a course of necessity, we needed to examine kind of the larger social context that the debate around gender has been a part of, and then a history of science class, which, you know, kind of encompassed a lot of sort of the other perspectives you bring to this, that, of course, science itself does not exist in isolation, that it exists in a larger social context. I mean, am I stating that last part right? I mean, is this sort of your book is an attempt to try to place things in that larger construct?
Absolutely. For me, that's always been the most satisfying way to approach science, to understand actually science and the wonder of science, is to understand how knowledge is produced in very particular cultural moments. And actually the cognitive work of science, all that reasoning and inferring and experimenting, is very much within a cultural milieu. We borrow concepts and motivation, gain motivation from cultural context. And so for me, that's all just part of explaining science and understanding its role in society. Now, within the history of sex and sex difference, of course, scientists have been searching for the biological basis of sex differences for hundreds of years, right?
Right.
Back, you know, hundreds of years ago when it was the skeleton, kind of at a very macro level that we could look at, scientists focused on the pelvis and on various structural differences in the skeleton. Then it was the cranium. Then it was the brain. Then it was the hormones. And the way I see things in this broad historical perspective is now it's the genome. The genome is a quantitative technology that we can use to precisely measure and quantify and search for the basis of differences between males and females. Now, this project of searching for differences has not been an apolitical project. It's always been part of a wider cultural debate, kind of seeking in science a neutral arbiter of what's real about sex. Right? What's plastic? What can be changed? And what perhaps is fixed and essential? And how our social order should be ordered? Should it be based on the natural? Or is it possible to transcend that and move beyond that? And I see the genomics of sex today, this new technology or materiality, as very much situated within that long line of inquiry.
Well, let's talk about just one, proposal that's been brought forth recently, and that's that essentially males and females have different genomes that that in very substantial ways. For example, that males and females may be genetically more different than, say, human beings and chimpanzees. Where would you place that in terms of its credibility?
Yes, in the book I take on this claim that males and females are more different than different species than humans and chimpanzees. Very, very provocative recent claim by a leading human genomicist, which represents one vision of sex differences in the genome, one that I argue strenuously against. Just to step back, when we think about the Human Genome Project, which got going in the late 1980s and really got started around 1990 and is generally understood to have been completed in the last decade or so, this was an era in which we were all promised that there's one human genome, that there's a universality, that the genome affirms our liberal universalist values, right? And this is a very different picture that's emerging from those who are interested in sex. I quote scientists who say there isn't one human genome, but two, a male genome and a female genome, conversations about the political correctness of this and whether we should look at sex differences or not. I see this view that there's a separate male and female genome as a view that really reflects this long history of looking for differences, a real strong focus on maleness and femaleness as a critical and important difference between humans that is the job of science to kind of locate and carve out and to tell us what's real. And I think it's striking because for a couple of different reasons. First of all, if we're patient with the data and we listen to what the genomic research is actually showing us, as I show in the book, actually the differences between males and females at the level of the genome are strikingly, even shockingly small. Mm-hmm. And that is the most provocative finding from one perspective of genomics, is how very, very small differences in the genome are. And even when you find differences, that is, males and females have the same genes, except for two genes on the Y chromosome that are unique to males, those genes in a male body versus in a female body might express at different levels. So this is a great object of interest at this moment. But even when you look at that, you find very, very small differences. And the differences you may find when you look at them functionally actually might equally explain convergence as they explain divergence. I'm sorry to lose you there for a moment, but there are differences in levels of gene expression between males and females,
sure,
but those differences might ultimately be part of pathways that make the male and female genome express at the same level. So it's a very complex science that is still quite emergent, and these strong statements of differences found between male and female genomes are quite premature and I think reflect cultural ideas about maleness and femaleness more than they do what the science is telling us.
Well, just to underline some of what you were saying just now, I think in one of the final chapters of your book, you take some of these general sweeping statements that have been made and then try to parse them. And one of them is this emphasis in research on difference that then sometimes eclipses gender similarities. And you quote the work of, I think, Janet Shibley Hyde, who's a psychologist who deals with those genetic gender similarities, rather gender similarities just in general. But it sounds like, you know, she's really kind of maybe more resonant with the thesis that you're bringing forth. And unfortunately, for better or for worse, a lot of research, again, takes the exception and really magnifies it rather than maybe identifying that greater reality.
Yeah, that's right. What Janet Shibley Hyde has proposed, and her work is mainly on psychology and brain differences, is she did a meta-analysis of research in that field on supposed sex differences in psychological variables. And she has proposed what she calls the similarities hypothesis, which is quite, you know, it really goes in the face of what we see as a meaningful, positive scientific result, right? Science is often driven to find a difference and report the difference, right? That's thought to be meaningful, whereas finding a similarity is thought to not be striking. And when she did a meta-analysis of all this research over many decades on sex differences, she found that the sex differences, when you look at them at a large statistical level, are so minute that they almost disappear. And that actually what the evidence shows is similarity. I often find in the genomics literature that there's a report of a finding of difference, but very little discussion of the biological or functional meaning of that difference. And so it's very easy to find differences using genomics. It's a quantitative technology. It's easy to run this study tissue by tissue, heart, liver, brain, or disorder by disorder, looking at diabetes or heart disease, and find sex differences. If sex is the variable you choose to focus on, sex rather than, say, age or reproductive status, and you can find them. But then when you start to look at their functional meaning, or the size or significance of those differences, I think researchers have not yet been able to make a compelling case that those differences are meaningful. Yet it's considered, in a world where scientists are pressured to constantly produce results, it's considered a finding to merely find a difference.
Okay. Well, let me just ask a basic question, if I could, just sort of your personal viewpoint and what got you involved in this area of science. You know, is it fair to ask, you know, what it means, I guess, today to be a feminist scientist or to have kind of a feminist philosophy of science? You know, as you're pointing out, you know, sometimes, especially in terms of the genetic components, we overemphasize this. But of course, sexism is a phenomenon. It's something that has greatly colored the way that we look at science. You know, in countless different ways. So is there something to be said of identifying of being a feminist scientist?
Sure. You know, I consider myself a scholar of feminism and science rather than, I'm not a scientist myself, but a historian and philosopher. And so what I have the privilege of studying is the interaction between cultural ideas about gender, including feminist ideas about gender over the last century, and scientific knowledge. And I think this is particularly when it comes to sex research, any sort of research on sex, a very profound and fascinating interaction that has a lot to tell us about how science works in society. So that's part of what it means to be a feminist science studies scholar, so to say. But also there's a role for science criticism. That is, there's a place for bringing extra pressure on ideas around sex differences in general. I also work on race, and thinking very, very critically about what biological research on difference means in practice within a larger ideological sphere, and situating it within that larger conversation. So that's also part of, I think, the role and place of a feminist critic of science, where criticism doesn't mean anti-science, but engaged and even loving engagement with that science. So a kind of way of, I think, bringing the tools of gender criticism to sharpen and hone our scientific concepts, to put a little pressure on them so that they might be as clear and as free of gender assumptions as they could possibly be.
Yeah, it reminds me of discussions in the history of science class, too, of the intersections of religious or spiritual perspectives in science, that it's a false dichotomy to say you have to choose one or the other, that very often there are intersections and common interests here.
Yeah, in the book, I actually have the opportunity to talk about scientists who do identify as feminist and the role that they have played in the history of sex chromosome research. Some of them have brought their own feminist assumptions to bear explicitly in their scientific research, actually changing scientific models in the field. I give the example of the search for the so-called male sex-determining gene and the role that feminist science analysts and feminist-identified scientists played in bringing this concept of gender that we talked about earlier to bear on complicating the basic model of genetic sex determination and challenging the idea that there should be a single master gene of sex determination and that that gene would be identical to the gene involved in testes determination. Now, today, as a result of their criticisms, we understand that any genetic account of sex determination has to include the processes involved in ovarian determination, female sex determination as well, and it includes many genes not just located on the sex chromosomes but all across the genome in variable and overlapping and redundant pathways that lead to a variety of sexual phenotypes. That's a pretty big transformation.
Yeah.
And it happened in part because of changing discourses around gender in the culture and partly brought about by feminist critics.
And it sounds also, as you mentioned at the outset, discussion of how this impacts on intersex or transgender people as well has led to new revelations.
Yes, I think, you know, we're entering an era where the where there are a lot of movements in biology to be more diversity affirming. And that's where I see an opening for a real critical discussion about how we want to formulate our notions of sex and gender difference in the genomic era. Right now, sex differences and gender differences are being redescribed in every field, from hormonal and brain differences to genomic differences. So everything will be recast in genomic terms. And there are ways in which an engaged science critic can play a role in formulating those basic conceptual tools, kind of the way we're going to carve out the categories of genomic research for the 21st century. And that's the kind of conversation that I'm urging. Now, that said, what a feminist approach to science is not or should not be is searching for some sort of affirmation of a view of gender equality in the genome or in biology, right? The idea is not to prefer some picture of biology that affirms our gender ideals, but rather to apply our strongest critical tools to any presentation of human difference so that we may be sure that it is not unwittingly incorporating social ideologies in ways that are not empirically grounded in the evidence.
Not to take us too far off topic, but does that have implications as well for identity in terms of sexual orientation? You know, some of my best friends who are involved with PFLAG, this parent support group for lesbians and gays, are just adamant that sexual orientation is something hardwired. You know, in part with the understandable, motivation that, of course, that makes it a clear-cut question, that it's not a matter of choice, and that there is just absolutely no basis for people to condemn people that they love because of their sexual orientation. But, you know, as I was discovering, of course, in my LGBT studies class or any examination, I think that those of us who are gay and lesbian, speaking for myself, we realize that probably is a bit more complicated than that, and probably it is both nature and nurture. It is a complicated intermixture, maybe not whether we are or aren't, but certainly that manifests the qualitative nature of who we are. It's not necessarily one or the other. So anyway, to come back to the basic question, does this have implications for sexual orientation as well?
I think you said it. I mean, the search for the gay gene or for the biological basis of sexual orientation is very much in the mode that I was just talking about. I think it tells us how important biology is to larger political and ideological debates about political status, equality, and ideological questions. Whether we like it or not, biology is there and it's a part of these big debates. And people, it's true that we're in a moment, you know, Lady Gaga's song, Born That Way, right? Mm-hmm. We're in this moment where an affirmation or a finding of identity in biology is thought to be politically liberating, right?
Right.
It's a very, very interesting phenomenon. But it is likely to be more complex than that. And I really think it is problematic to ground our political efforts on some sort of finding in biology, which, by the way, there has been no gay gene found.
Yeah.
And those efforts are another great example of the way in which social views can be brought to research in biology, and the way in which the genome has become especially this space for negotiating what's real and what's not, right? So it's a great example of how socially embedded our biological questions are. Again, genomics and biology is not some neutral space for cashing out social questions, but it's just part of a broader conversation. And that's kind of what I hope to do with this discussion about the history of the X and Y chromosome, where I show how the X and Y have been gendered as female and male, and all these episodes in the history of research in this field where the notions of sex, gender, and indeed sexuality and sexual orientation have been sourced to the X and Y only to be overturned and shown to be ideologically based. And that history is with us today, and it carries lessons for research on sex difference today.
For those of you who are just joining us midstream, we want to remind you this is Public Affair. I'm your guest host for today, John Quinlan, and my guest for the remainder of the hour is Sarah Richardson. She's the author of Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome, as we're discovering just many, many implications for this, both in terms of the biological and the societal and social factors that influence both gender and sex, one being perhaps more in the realm of culture and experience, the other in the realm of biology. Join in this discussion. What do you think? Have you figured this out in terms of your own experience, your own identity, or the experience of discrimination in the world? What are the fundamental truths here? And how important is this for us to engage in this authentic discussion? Sarah, as we're talking, this is reminding me of an interview from several years ago, which is just one of my most memorable interviews I've done. It was with a young man who had been labeled learning disabled at a young age. And just in essence, part of his journey of discovery, I think, was to look at how society views this concept of being normal. And I think one of the implications of what we were just talking about is whether someone is the way that they are because it's hardwired in the sense of biology or because of life experience or choice or other things. I mean, the bottom line is we get into trouble as a society when we try to put everyone in the same box and make them the same way. And what, in this case, Jonathan Mooney was reporting was to look at the history going back to the turn of the century and how this took us in some really dangerous directions, especially in terms of the eugenics movement, other movements that try to make everyone the same. What he talked about in the area of disability is a different way of looking at things and understanding about the value of cognitive diversity, people learning and thinking in different ways, and that perhaps some of our problems are more linked to dysteachia than they are to dyslexia. It's not understanding that we need to deal with people where they're coming from and not trying to make them into something that they aren't. But I'm putting a lot of stuff out there, but I guess especially in this concept of where we've gone wrong in terms of that earlier history of eugenics, how does that impact on the discussion we're having?
Well, one of my favorite examples of, I mean, what you're talking about is hereditarianism and genetic determinism and these kind of hardline ideas about finding human traits and characteristics and even intellectual abilities and behavioral tendencies in the genome as a real prominent strain of the 20th century life sciences, and it remains to be determined how strong that will be in the coming century. One of my favorite examples from sex chromosome research is the famous case of the so-called XYY supermale. In the 1960s and 1970s, it was found that some males have an extra Y chromosome. And just to back up, males and females have 22 pairs of autosomes that are identical in males and females, and females have a pair of sex chromosomes, the X and the X, and males have an X and a Y. So there were found some males who have an extra Y. So we call them XYY. And the thesis was formulated. The first idea of what this did was that the extra Y chromosome made these males super males. It made them more aggressive, more likely to commit criminal activity, more sexual, bigger. So extra male, in short, according to the ideas of what masculinity constituted in the 1960s and 1970s. And for two decades, research on the human Y chromosome focused intensively on this behavioral genetics hypothesis that it was XYY males that you would find more in prisons, more having committed rape and sexual crimes and aggressive crimes. And in short, the outcome of this is one of the most embarrassing episodes in 20th century genetics and a very formative moment in the field of behavioral genetics, where the Y chromosome, it turns out, the extra Y chromosome does not dispose males in any way to higher rates of aggression or criminality. And in the meantime, research was misdirected to this question for two decades, and men with an extra Y chromosome were stigmatized as being potentially behaviorally problematic. So in this case, we can see very clearly how cultural ideas about maleness is instantiated in the Y chromosome, and therefore the extra Y constituting a kind of extra dose of maleness, right?
Yeah.
Played a very key role in this problematic and famous example of kind of an embarrassing overstatement of the possibilities for genomics. It's interesting because I talk with people today who still think that an extra Y chromosome makes some males into criminals. It was such a resonant cultural idea. It filtered into popular culture, and there were books and movies that used the concept. And so it's just a great example of how our cultural ideas around gender can have, in the past, played a role in scientific knowledge with real consequences.
Well, it tells you why the work that you're doing is so important, because those misconceptions linger for a long time. It's really important to get at the deeper truth there. We do have a caller. Your comment or question, please.
Yeah, I have a personal experience that I think disproves anybody's idea that sexual preference is chosen. I was maybe 4 years old and maybe three, and went for swimming lessons with my mom. And, of course, they're not going to have me go in the men's locker room. I'm with my mom. What would be the harm of a little boy going with his mom? And I specifically remember this, seeing, the other mothers getting dressed in their swimming suits and seeing things. And I remember being very titillated by that. How in the world could a kid that age know what he was seeing? And certainly not a choice in my preference. Does that make sense? I remember seeing that and being very, it was very interesting to me in a sexual way. I mean, I didn't know anything from anything at that age.
And that contradicts your experience in later years. Is that right? In part?
What's that?
And that contradicts your experience of later years? Is that in part?
I mean that my preference from a very early age was obviously attracted to the opposite sex.
Yeah. Okay.
No, that it was not a choice.
Understand. Okay, Sarah, any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a great book that came out recently by someone who does work like mine, whose name is Rebecca Jordan Young, and it's called Brainstorm. And so my book is more about the human genome, but she looks more at theories of gender and sexual development in the brain. And this is a very, very complex area, but it is clear that sexual preference forms quite early, and the factors involved in that are not yet fully understood in humans. As I said before, with genetic and genomic research, there have been many, many attempts to try to understand the genomics of sexual orientation, and not all of them have been kind of laughable flops at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's looking like sexual orientation is a complex social and psychodynamic process that almost certainly has biological dimensions as well as social dimensions. And here we're getting into an area where sex and gender, we started the discussion by saying, here's the distinction between sex and gender, but what is so interesting and exciting about research on sex today is that we're able to study how sex and gender, in fact, interact.
Yeah.
So there are biological dimensions and there are social dimensions, and they loop into each other and carve into each other, starting at a very, very early age. I'll give an example not from sexuality, but from general changes in history around women in sport. It used to be that clinicians thought females just didn't have the same knee vulnerabilities as males do. But now in the post-Title IX era, we know that females are just as, if not more, likely to get those ACL injuries on the knees. Culture imbricates our understanding of biological potentiality, right?
Right.
And I think that's happening at both an individual developmental level with sexual orientation and at a macro level with large-scale changes in the cultures around gender.
Another resonant example, if I remember this correctly, in your book was talking about osteoporosis in women.
Yes.
So the fragility of women and what we perceive to be a more likelihood that their bones will break or they're more fragile. But you said you kind of, again, parsed that out, saying perhaps that's not so much biological as it does have sort of cultural roots to it as well.
Absolutely. The level of hard labor and exercise that women in different cultures and in different times have performed, as well as the level of vitamin D exposure, which is dependent on cultural ideas around constricted and covering clothing, has a big impact on osteoporosis. And this is another interesting scholar. Some of your listeners, if you're interested in these kinds of perspectives, would be interested in Anne Fausto Sterling, who is a biologist at Brown University, who's done just wonderful work on exactly these kinds of interrelations between gender and culture and biology. There's another, we'll just give one more example,
sure.
Which is from Nancy Krieger, an epidemiologist at Harvard, and her example is keratinitis, infections due to contact lens infections. And the rate of this is very high, much higher in men than in women. Now, if you're a strict biological determinist, you might say, well, men must be more genetically susceptible
right.
to these kinds of infections. But if you look clearly at the practices, cultural practices around cleanliness and contact
yep.
lenses, you find that it's really different cultural practices that are gendered also around hygiene and contact lenses.
Yeah, I think you need to maybe break down the practices of compulsively clean gay men, and that would give you even more.
Exactly. We could just look right. it to a whole other level there.
Exactly. All right. Yeah, we're speaking with Sarah Richardson. She's the author of Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. I want to, in the closing, in the last 15 minutes or so here, come back to the promise that's inherent in, again, as we talked about the intersections of gender and sex. But I wanted to just return to one other, going back, you've given that example of the males with the extra chromosome and how they were stereotyped. But in terms of women and the intersection with this, whether we're back in the 1920s and the way that women who were seen as atypical or abnormal in their gender roles, how I want to talk about that a little bit, but to note that that's a phenomenon that society unfortunately has engaged with quite recently. In some ways, in some parts of the world, probably still is engaging with. The example that stands out in my mind is I had a good friend who was a newspaper person here at the Capital Times, and his name is Brooks Edgerton. In this case, he happened to also be a gay male community leader. But he wrote an investigative series about the experience of a woman who had lived in the mid-1970s, who was involuntarily committed to our local Mendota Mental Health Institute. And the sole basis of that diagnosis was her inability to conform to social norms. Her family believed that it wasn't normal for her not to wear a dress or to do other chores and tasks and things, connected to that identity, what they thought a woman should be. And she was actually put away and she was treated for that. And that, unfortunately, isn't totally an isolated phenomenon, is it?
Oh, it's not. If you look at the history of gender and psychiatry, it really is. This is another area where there are just fascinating interactions between gender norms and kind of the medical management of females. The idea that, that any expression of gender identity outside of a normative, heterosexual, performative kind of frame was indicative of some kind of mental disorder, was a way of looking to medicine to try to manage social discomforts around gender performance. And both women who refused to engage in heterosexual activity, so-called sexually frigid women, would be thought of as ill, and women who engaged in same-sex activity were thought of as ill, and have long, both women and men of same-sex preferences have long been objects of scientific study in practices designed to study what was thought of as deviancy and thought of medicalized as a disorder. And it really, until the 1970s, as you know, homosexuality was included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. So this is a long history of medicalizing abnormality, right? Where there's and at the same time putting the stamp of health on so-called normality in sexual behavior.
Well, for people who are transgender, there's this extra dimension in the DSM I think, is it GRID, the acronym anyway, in terms of identifying transgender identity mm-hmm. as a pathology, as something that needs to be treated. And it's a catch-22, because in order to be eligible for subsidy for surgery and for other things, one has to have a diagnosis. And yet there are folks within that movement that says, but this contradicts what we're saying, that we are simply who we are.
Right. So, what is it? Disordered GRID these days. Disordered gender identity disorders of gender identity. The idea that you have to have a diagnosis in order to obtain treatment puts people. It does recall this notion of having to have some sort of problematic, possibly not entirely straightforward and honest relationship with medicine in order to obtain the resources needed to transition if one wants to or otherwise obtain therapy. So this is a continuing issue. I should say that in the book, as well as talking about the Y chromosome, of course, I talk about the X chromosome. Mm-hmm. So you were mentioning females and ideas around femininity, which have equally kind of coalesced around the X as the Y. So the notion of the doubledness of the X chromosome in females has been a particularly rich arena for speculating about the nature of femininity as kind of doubled and changeable and expressing two different perspectives as deceptive and kind of divided against itself, whereas men have just a single simple X chromosome along with their Y chromosome. So I also spend some time looking at that and its implications for biomedical research and women's health research.
So once again, the benefit of a gay male perspective is to the extent that any of those stereotypes are true of individual women, they can obviously be true of men. So we know these things just don't apply. We're down to about our last 6 minutes, but I guess what I'd like to do, because what we're doing, what you're describing is such a complicated phenomenon, if we can kind of distill it down again, I guess, to the positive implications of a more nuanced and complicated view of both gender and sex. You made the point that we shouldn't go into this discussion kind of with an agenda or conclusion in mind. So whether it's sexual orientation or a feminist perspective, you know, we shouldn't necessarily, you know, try to seek out only that data that corresponds to our underlying belief. But I think there is something to be said that if you look at the big picture, though, it's a liberating picture, because it is one that says human beings are just very complicated, and we, as individuals, can't be painted with a broad brush, whether it's because of gender or sex or other characteristics, and let's embrace all of that wonderful, beautiful complexity.
I agree with that. I think that we have to kind of back up and look at what the data is telling us and let it emerge and change over time. But there are a couple of points to make here. I think you're absolutely right that one important thing to see with sex and gender is that sex itself is a multi-layered concept. We can talk about sex at the level of the XX and the XY chromosomes, but then we can talk about it at the gonadal level, at the hormonal level. Some are even comfortable talking about brain gender, and then we have various forms of gender identity, sexual orientation, and sexual identity. And so it's a complex and multi-leveled concept that cannot be reduced to any one thing. The second point is that what is the genome telling us? I give a lot of examples of confounding research that surprises those who have an expectation that we'll find the essence of maleness on the Y and the essence of femaleness on the X. I'll give a couple quick examples. One is that it turns out that the largest collection of genes involved in male spermatogenesis, the production of sperm, are actually located on the X chromosome. And I give some wonderful quotations from scientists at their level of surprise and disbelief in finding this to be true. Turns out that the X chromosome is much more specialized in male-specific traits than in female ones. Another example is when you look at genes that differ in levels of expression between male and female bodies, there are very few, as I mentioned before, and when they differ, the levels of difference are extremely small, often not meeting standards of statistical significance. However, there's one gene that simply leaps off the page. It differs in its level of expression hugely between males and females. It's called the EXIST gene. It's located on the X chromosome and expresses much higher in females. So, wow, that looks like a huge difference. But when you look at the actual biological function of the EXIST gene, it is to inactivate the second X chromosome in females. In short, what the EXIST gene does is it makes only one X chromosome express in each female cell to equalize the level of X chromosome dosage between males and females. So these are just a couple of examples of convergence of the ways in which our expectations about how the genome relates to sex and gender are being upturned, and I think we should attend to those and learn from them and also learn from history and try to open up our perspective around the relationship between this new hot science of the 21st century and our ideas around sex and gender. What I'd like us not to do is slip back into that old binary conception. Instead, I'd like biologists to join in this broader conversation that's going around around sex differences and build that into the questions that they're asking and the way that they interpret and see the data that they're receiving.
I guess in light of what you're saying, what solution is there in terms of public education? Sex education, unfortunately, has been on the wane as political forces have kind of removed it in many cases from the schools. But in an ideal world, would high school age and young people be having discussions about these very things?
Well, it's so interesting that you ask that. One thing that happens for the science teachers listening, perhaps, is that science textbooks really, really lag behind the cutting edge of the science. So I still find science textbooks that refer to the XYY as the supermale syndrome, that suggest that there's a single gene on the Y chromosome that controls like a master gene sex determination, and that teach the bare minimum about the XX and the XY so that you get a very essentialist picture of sex. So engaging with new science and indeed teaching students and helping students find that new science, read it, and interpret it themselves, I think is part of developing both curiosity and skepticism about science. Those two things are at the heart, I think, of what we appreciate about science. I've been invited, I'm so excited, later this year to go to the World Congress of Science in D.C. and to use some of the ideas from this book to teach children to kind of use the idea of the genetics of sex to teach children about fundamental concepts in biology. And I'm really excited about that invitation, that these kinds of critical perspectives about these old-fashioned ideas about sex are seen as actually a way to intrigue,
Sarah,
a way to invite people into the interesting debates within science.
And on that thought, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but hope is, of course, that this is integrated into public education again. So many interesting concepts here we've had a chance to talk about. Sarah Richardson is the author of Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome, and we thank you so much for being here on A Public Affair.
Thanks.
I'm your host, John Quinlan.